Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week, I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And my guest this week is George Holden. George is a YouTuber and street photographer who's been making videos for a few years now and is friends with some previous guests of the show, like Emily, who does the Micro Four Nerds website and channel. He's a really great photographer and I really like his videos because, like me, he has tried to simplify his setup and pare things down. It's a recent initiative and he and I were chatting about it on social media and I suggested he come on a podcast to talk about it. He said yes, and so here we are. He's got some really interesting lenses to share today and a really fun perspective on making things, so I think you'll really enjoy this one. Here's my conversation with George.
Well, yeah, I found a lot of the podcasts that I've listened to over the years that are audio only, I've never once thought like, oh, I wish I could watch this. A lot of them, It's more about the chat and they're not like referencing news stories where they might be showing stuff. If it's just the conversation, it's kind of like, well, what's the video even for? Especially if it's like webcam video.
Yeah, I think it still might be a hangover from that time that Facebook tried to convince the world that we should pivot to video, which is getting on for 10 years ago now. But I think that there is still a shockwave coming out of that the assumption was everything had to be video there and everything had to be kind of visual. And I think, I don't know, like being in people's ears, this goes right back to one of the early conversations I had for this series with a guy called Julian, who makes a podcast in France, Julian Pasternak. And he was talking about, like, you know, if you're in people's ears, that's a lovely personal place to be. And people really connect and they hear what you're saying and you go with them places. Whereas if they're watching on video, maybe you're on their phone whilst the kettle boils or whatever, but you're not quite fighting for attention in the same way, which I think is quite nice. And if they let you in, then what a privilege.
Yeah, I also find that I feel like there's a lot of podcasts that I'll listen to either like driving or doing like chores around the house or whatever else it might be. Yeah. And it just becomes like this passive thing.
Yeah.
But it's really good because you do end up spending like hours with someone rather than like a few 60-second chunks or something like that. Yeah. So I agree. I do really like it as a platform. Yeah. And I feel like it's now like it's become such the norm. It's replaced so much. Like I listen to podcasts more than music these days, which I never thought I would say, but definitely.
I had one over Christmas because I, with my day job being in games, I listen to a lot of games stuff as well. And one of the podcasts I listened to, Into the Aether, they did a 6-hour Christmas, like end of year wrap up. And I listened to it and got to the end and they were like, yeah, I can't believe we've done 6 hours again. I was like, it's not six. And I looked at the play and it was. I just listened to it. You know that week in between Christmas where no one really knows what day it is and you're just floating.
The Twilight Zone.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the soundtrack to that period. And I just, over a few days, and I just knocked it out over a few days and I didn't really realise that I'd spent 6 hours listening to these guys talking about games.
But that's like some audiobooks are like 6 hours. So that's good going from them to just chat nonstop for 6 hours.
Yes. No, I'm not sure I could do it. But then again, as we kind of segue nicely into the show, like that I think is the thing. I'm coming up on a year of doing this now. And you're gonna be like episode 47, something like that. 48?
Oh wow, so well
like
done.
So yeah, so cheers. So we're nearly there at an episode a week for a whole year. We're very, very close. So I have a fun plan. Being a dad, it's a dad joke, but I have a fun plan for the anniversary, so it's gonna be really good. But yeah. It's gonna be very cool. But how are you? How's sunny Manchester today?
Manchester is gorgeous as always. Lovely diffused light. That's to be honest, people say I wish the sun was out here, but at the same time when you're shooting video outside, softbox all the time. And only problem is the wind. It gets very, very windy here, so audio outside is a pain. But if you're just shooting silent b-roll, what more do you want? You've got a massive softbox in the sky. So yeah, it definitely has its benefits. And when I go somewhere with nice sun, I think, oh wow, it's so beautiful here for photographs. But then as soon as I start recording video, I'm like, why is everything so high contrast? It's take me back to gloomy England.
It's funny, I have a friend who's from Australia and she talked about that when she was on the show, that you learn to shoot with a flash in Australia outdoors, which I'd never really thought about. Like a very.
I would not have thought of that.
No, that's but you do. You've got. You need Phil Flash. Yeah. That's it's an essential skill. That Martin Parr approach to kind of photographing outdoors, but with a flash. Like, yeah, an essential Australian photography skill.
Yeah, you would think like with an abundance of light, it's like surely you guys never need to worry about this.
So, have you been out to like this weekend? How was your like street photo life?
Street photo life the last weekend was good. I actually met up with a couple of other photographers on Saturday, all with very different kit. So we were chatting about kit, chatting about sort of stuff that we shoot, walking the usual sort of bits of Manchester. But it was, you know, the weekend here, it sort of varies a lot. I think because the weather's quite gloomy, a lot of people weren't out. But still some interesting stuff, but lots of dogs, so I gravitate towards those all the time.
How very Elliot Erwitt of you. That's...
Exactly. But I also, as you mentioned Martin Parr, I feel like I literally go between those two inspirations. I go between like my grey day, black and white dog stuff a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I'm abroad, I just follow the Brits abroad and I'm just like, right, let's get the Parr on. which is great. And actually, funnily enough, Martin Parr is doing a talk on February the 8th in Manchester. We're going to that. Which should be really cool. I haven't seen him do a talk before, so that'd be very cool.
Is that related to the film that's coming out, the documentary?
You know, I saw the trailer for the film after I bought the ticket for the talk, so maybe it is part of a promotion. But yeah, I know a bunch of photographers in Manchester who we all jumped to getting tickets, so I think it'll be really cool.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. I've contacted the distributor for that film in the hopes that I can talk to them about it before it comes out, because that would be brilliant to talk to the people making that. I had a guy called Andy Dunn on. I don't know if you've listened to that episode, talking about a documentary he made about Harold Feinstein. So it's a nice kind of photography adjacent thing. I always get jealous of people with podcasts where they can talk to anyone about anything, whereas I'm in a lane, so I'm kind of constantly looking for ways to kind of poke out of the lane a little bit. So a filmmaker, it's photo adjacent.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think as well, when it comes to photography, people who are into photography are sometimes coming at it from more the technical side, sometimes more from the pure art, visual art side. People always have like their own angles of how they got into it. So even when you meet someone out and about with a camera, you always find out like, what did you start shooting first? Or someone started shooting music, or someone started shooting landscapes.
Right.
And then you end up talking about all that sort of stuff. I find it's rare that you have two photographers that came at it from the exact same way, which is always interesting.
Well, that's a nice jump onto something I wanted to ask you about, actually, which was about the fact you are very street. You know, there's no way I look at your channel and your work and stuff and go, oh, I wonder if he likes still life. Like, was street your first love? Was it an instant first love, or did you come to it via a bunch of other forms of photography?
I think it was kind of accidental. I first got into cameras and video, mostly video, but we're talking like old digicams before we called them digicams.
Right.
But when I was shooting like the 360p, 480p, like doing videos and stuff like that. And then I did filmmaking at school and at university. And then I actually worked in TV for a little bit. But then filmmaking, like independent stuff and like photography was always on the side. And then when I first picked up a film camera, it's kind of when I started doing what I guess you could look back at and call street. It was much more the candid stuff. And then it was only later that I actually discovered what street photography even was. And I was like, oh, that actually, suddenly a lot of my stuff fits into this bracket. And I started to realize it's something I can do outside of freelance work. There's not really like a reliance on other people to be creative with this medium. And I really liked it to kind of like blow off the cobwebs a lot of the time. So in between freelance gigs, if you're waiting for jobs to come along or you're sort of in the edit for a lot of jobs, this could get you out of the house with a camera and just kind of enjoy it for the sake of it, which I always really liked. And then as I learned more and more about it, it's one of those great things where the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And you're like, whoa, this is a deep rabbit hole. And I think I'm probably like 3 years deep into actually going down the rabbit hole. Which has been good. But yeah, definitely I always come back to the basics of like photographing dogs, which is kind of like one of the ways I got started with photography. And that's a great way to connect with people on the street as well.
Yeah.
Much rather than just doing the candid stuff.
Right. So you want to be out in the world. You want to be interacting with your subject a little bit as well. You're not a detached observer.
I think it's sort of like ebbs and flows. Like sometimes I'm a bit more introverted and sometimes I'm much more extroverted. So yeah, sometimes I can be out and kind of just do my own thing. Might not interact with anyone properly, but I'll include lots of people in competitions. I shoot pretty wide. Yeah. So I do get quite close a lot of the time. But then if there's a shot that I really want that I know I pretty much have to speak to this person or I have to like make eye contact with them to make something work, then I'm also like happy to do that. Definitely much more in Manchester because it's a very small town. So I find it's much better to get to know people while I'm shooting rather than just like running around, stealing photos and then disappearing. So I think it's quite good to be a bit more like a part of the community taking photos rather than just like popping in with a flash and running off.
Well, especially if you're looping. Like I was, you know, watching some of your more recent stuff recently and like that looping approach of like going around a place. And you mentioned Andre Wagner, who I love as well, who's just, I think, is the most exciting. I caveat this. I do not know tons about street photography. I would not be like an expert street photography person. However, his work, I love it. But I think, and I've mentioned it on the show before, but he has done a great job talking about being in those communities and knowing people and going back to the same places over and over again. So if you're popping up often, you don't want to, you know, it's actually going to be beneficial to you, isn't it? To kind of be known to the people in the area and be able to have a chat with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find it funny. I'll have taken someone's photo like months ago, either them or with their dog, and then I'll see them again. And then they'll be kind of like, oh, it's you. Oh, do you want another photo? And I'm like, yeah, let's go on, let's do it. I've already got your email. I'll send you another one, which is always nice. And I feel like once people see you photographing people in a friendly way, and then they see you doing stuff candid, they're a bit less like suspicious of you. And they're kind of like, oh, well, clearly those people like him, so he must be okay. But funny you mentioned Andre D. Wagner, he also does amazing press stuff and like behind the scenes photography. And just today there was a photo of Lewis Hamilton has just started driving for Ferrari in Formula One. And Andre D. Wagner's taken the portrait of Lewis Hamilton outside like the Ferrari HQ. I just saw it literally just before we got on the call. I was like, yes. Like his work is so varied.
Yeah.
But I love everything. His colour stuff and his black and white. Everything's gorgeous.
The stuff he did for Queen and Slim, the photo
shoot for with Daniel Clue, yeah.
So good. Those photos are incredible. Like, yeah, I've messaged Andre. I'd love to kind of get to him. I mean, as much as the show started because I had a dream about talking to Jason Momoa, about his lens collection. So as much as I want to get to him in the end, like, Andre's on the list as well of people I would love to kind of, you know, figure out a 6 degrees of separation to eventually kind of get in touch. You know, I think with people like that, you need the introduction. Like there's no point me just emailing studio@.
I mean, you never know. You might catch him at a quiet time and he goes like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
Have a nice chat.
Yeah. That's how I got Doug Menway. Actually, the email I got back from him was a stream of consciousness of basically someone working out whether or not they actually wanted to do it, and then at the end going, sure, why not? Like he was having the Stettler and Waldorf conversation with himself in email format, and then eventually said yes. But generally, people don't show they're working; they either say yes or it's just silence. You know?
Yeah. Usually, they edit the message, but if you send the whole stream of consciousness, it's like, oh, it looks like a no. Oh, it turned to a yes at the end.
Yeah. No, you've got to read things properly is the other thing I've learned about like doing this for a little while. Do you do much collaboration stuff? I know you know Emily, don't you?
I do know Emily. Yeah. Absolute legend.
Yeah.
She's also based in the Northwest. So we've met up a handful of times and made a couple of videos together. I do collaborate as well with other people who are maybe a little bit outside of my immediate niche. And we help each other film and stuff around Manchester. And so it's always been nice, like creative communities. And even when I lived over in like West Yorkshire in Leeds, I got to know all the creative community there as well. Because once you find people who are doing photography or doing YouTube, for example, you know you speak the same language. So you get into stuff and like you can easily work together quite quickly, which is always fun.
Yeah, well, I think that's a danger with the platforms these days is that very much they're set up to sort of facilitate a solo creator and not necessarily to facilitate like groups of people working together. So at least at least if even in real life you've got that group you can go and talk to, even if the platform isn't built for that. Because otherwise it could be a really lonely existence being a YouTuber.
Yeah, I think it can. It was interesting once I sort of refocused on photography, because for a couple of years I was sort of during COVID, immediately post COVID, I was doing like building PCs and stuff like that. Because I didn't have much money for a new Mac at the time. They weren't as good as they are now. And I built PCs, made videos on that. And that was kind of like my first bit of immediate traction. And then once lockdown stopped and I was like wanting to do more photography content, I was like, right, I'm just going to do hard pivot, go photography. This is what I know more about. This is what I want to do long term. But as soon as I started doing that, you just immediately met people. You immediately connected with people through comments and Instagram and stuff like that. And it can be a very solo job, but as soon as you speak to someone else who does the same thing, they are kind of like your colleagues and you can become friends quite quickly, which is really nice. And definitely everyone I've met, like occasionally I'll get spotted in Manchester and people come say hi. And that's really weird, but it's also really nice because people come up and be like, oh, I love this specific video. And you're like, oh, cool. I didn't know if anyone actually liked that one. So it's nice when people come up and like mention a very specific thing. And likewise with Emily, when I've been with her in Manchester, she gets recognized like once or twice every time she's here. It's amazing. But she has such a devout, specific fan base. And yeah, they all absolutely love her stuff, which is great.
Yeah. The cameras she loves as well are the kinds of cameras that people really work hard to love. You know, they like this because there's certain tribes within photography, I guess. Like you find your people, you find your group. You know, there's the rangefindery type people, there's the Fuji people, there's the Sony people. You know, all the different groups. You find your groups, and then Micro Four Thirds is just like this hardcore of people who are like true believers at this point in this thing. It's gone beyond. I don't even know if anyone's still making any new. I guess Olympus still are.
Yeah, I think Lumix are.
Yeah.
But who knows when. But obviously yes. the GH7 came out and G9 too.
Of course.
And Olympus or OM System now are doing something. But like, who knows? And I would be very interested to see because I'm a big Micro Four Thirds fan. But I do also, I'm very brand agnostic. I kind of change stuff quite a lot. My main core stuff for video is Sony just because it's pretty easy. It just works. But then all my other stuff, I change all the time. Like I would love to be rangefinders only, but the only digital rangefinders that exist are Leica. And I'm like, well, maybe not. So I would really love to see something else.
Like an X-Pro. An X-Pro has that feel, doesn't it?
Sort of. I've played with the X100s and the X-Pros, but I don't like their optical viewfinders, because once you've used an actual rangefinder, so I have like a couple of 35mm film rangefinders that I shoot with, and once you've used one of those, it's like, oh, I can't go and use the Fuji one. I want like an actual rangefinder. So yeah, for now, I'm still Sony, but I'm always, especially for photography, I'm always like, I'm open, but I've managed to commit this year to just using like the two cameras that I have. And I'm like, let's just do that.
We can jump onto that because that's a good segue onto then your lens selection, which I was really excited about. And there's a couple of things I noted by that I thought were interesting. But talk me through what made you decide to simplify a bit this year, or at least aspire to simplify. You know, it's only January.
Yeah, I mean, I have two photographers I was with the other day said, I give you 3 months. That is no way. They were like, I don't know how you're going to get that far. But I think for me, like, I kind of don't have a camera at the moment that I immediately want to try. And usually there's always been like, oh, 2 months with one, 2 months with another, and I'll sort of be chopping and changing. But I picked up my RX1 in August of last year, and it's now been just over 4 months. And I don't want to get rid of it. And my other camera is my A7 C2 that is good for video and for a lot of photography. And I'm quite happy with that. It's kind of like on paper, it's everything I need. And I'm sort of like, there's no incentive for me now to change. So if I was to change, it would purely be like gear acquisition syndrome. Just like, let's try something for the sake of it. And again, having a YouTube channel, there is an incentive to try a camera, because then you can make videos about the camera and whatever. But at the same time, I'm sort of like, well, if there's not a video, if there's not a camera that I'm immediately excited about, there's not really a reason for me to get one. So I was like, I'm just going to set myself a challenge for a year to not pick up anything else and to really like, for my photography, it doesn't really make a difference. And for making videos, it doesn't make a difference. But it's more like having different subject matter in videos is kind of the only incentive. And I wanted to kind of remove that option. I wanted to be like, let's get back to just talking about street photography, how to shoot street photography, and common issues that we have, and focus on that for the next year on my channel. So not having cameras in the mix kind of simplifies that a lot more. And so far it's been really good. I'm immediately like, okay, cool. I'm not talking about lenses. I'm not talking about resolution or anything like that. I'm just getting back to like the absolute basics, which has been quite good so far. I'm halfway through editing a video at the moment that I love, like way more than any of my camera videos. So I'm like, this feels more fulfilling. And then my photography is much more simplified. I'm not trying a new autofocus system or dealing with new quirks of a new camera. I can just focus on like the photography itself.
The RX1 was on my dream camera list when it first came out. It's still kind of like pulls at the heartstrings a little bit because I had an A7 at the time. And I was the lens that basically never left the front of my A7, although it did occasionally, but for most of the time it was the 35 Zeiss, the 2.8. Because it's so small, and it turned that original A7 into such a portable little amazing full frame camera at the time. It's incredible. It's like what, 12 years ago now, but that was an amazing combination. And so when that came out and it was even smaller but had effectively the same lens on the front, kinda sorta, you know, like it was f2 instead of 2.8, but you know, and that's one of your choices, like it seems like that lens was an absolute banger. Like, are you enjoying what it's giving you in that little package?
Yeah, I think it's the most unique camera I've ever used. And that's saying something. I've used a lot. And it's like one of those cameras that I saw it for the first time like 10 years ago in real life. Like a student at my university had one. And I was like, how the hell did you get that? And when I finally got around to getting one, and just it's smaller than most Micro Four Thirds cameras. And it's a full frame sensor and it's got that lens on the front. It's just, you're never going to get something as good as that. So I definitely will at some point be getting the latest version, but only when I can get it on a good deal. I'm not going to pay the price it's currently going for.
No, well, I was going to say it's never gone down in price, has it?
It's crazy. Yeah. The RX1 does go a bit cheaper, but the caveat, like the trade-offs are noticeable in terms of like the autofocus is pretty poor. The tracking is surprisingly good, but then there's no phase detect or autofocus continuous. So you are kind of stuck with just autofocus single. So if things are moving quickly, you have to kind of do fake zone focusing, which is what I do most of the time, which is still pretty good. And luckily I'm stopping down to like F8, F11 most of the time. I just sort of shoot zone like that. And I still think the look of the lens is amazing. So nice. And I fully thought I'd only have it for maybe a month or two. And then I just couldn't bring myself to get rid of it. I was like, okay, I guess you're staying until I can upgrade to the better autofocus model. I'm going to stick with it.
But it's also nice because it's not a very imposing package. So I shoot with an M, and that's the thing as well about like people don't respond to it, you know, like that camera you're talking about there looks like it could almost be a point and shoot. Someone at the corner of their eye would just be like, oh, that's fine, that's not, you know, you're not rocking up in front of someone with like a massive lens and a massive body that screams proper photographer. And yet, as you say, the quality and the rendering of the lens is just, it's way out there, but you've not had to compromise. You've just got this nice small thing you can put in your bag, charge over USB, all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, honestly, it fits in my jacket pocket of most of my jackets. So it's literally that camera. So if I don't want to go out with my A7 C2 and a prime lens on that or a zoom lens on that, and I'm not definitely going to take photos, I can shove this in my jacket pocket or on like a very small sling bag and just take it with me in case I start to see something. And I think that's something that you can kind of, I mean, that's why Micro Four Thirds are so good. And most of those cameras will fit in your pocket. So I think having a camera like that is really important if you're into street photography. And then you can have something that's a bit bigger, that is more, I'm going out today purely with the intent of taking photos. But the RX1 kind of can do the more casual and the more serious, which I really like. But yeah, in general, I kind of just wish Sony would make a new one, but I don't think it's happening anytime soon. There's always rumors, but I don't think it's ever going to happen.
I mean, I know a couple of people at Sony. I'll ask them. I'm sure they won't tell me. But that's the other thing, is that with the, you know, Leica's Q line is joked about as, like, we all joke about it being the gateway drug to the Leica line, right? So, like, I don't fully understand why they wouldn't invest in it, because there's clearly a market there, because they're not shy about charging money. They've got no problem. Sony have no problem charging money for things. And also, their industrial design, the handling of the, like, the amount that they pack into something, you know, it clearly appeals to you, because it doesn't escape my notice that most of the cameras, a lot of the cameras you talk about are, like you say, they're quite small, they're quite clever. Like, there's something clever about the way they're put together, whether it's a clever Micro Four Thirds thing that's also managed to fit in IBIS into a tiny package or whatever, or whether it's something like this Sony that just, it's the reason I love the GR3. For example, again, same thing.
Yeah.
Absurdly tiny package with incredible image quality packed into something that is extremely unassuming, but you can, you know, if you're careful, you can blow those things up to be massive and you wouldn't know the difference. It's, you know, like you were saying in your cropping episode, like, what are you seeking here? Are you seeking perfection, or are you seeking kind of getting the job done? Because great artists ship. They don't care about, you know, it's that joke, isn't it, about, like, painters when they get together. It's like, they don't discuss art. They discuss where you can get cheap paint. Like, that's the thing you worry about. Is like, well, I wanted to achieve a thing, and then I'm trying to achieve the more perfect version of that thing, like with your dog pictures. Like, once you've got a topic, then you can refine and improve and pursue that. So, yeah, I don't know why they wouldn't make another one. It seems to me so obvious.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that, like, you know, in a couple of years' time, once they've kind of got all of this new vlogging camera stuff out of the system, maybe they'll finally go, actually, photography.
Remember that?
Like, it's not sports photography. Or should we just do some of that? But yeah. I don't know. We might be waiting a very long time.
Because
they definitely do innovate, and they are making interesting things. But I think we've kind of hit a plateau, especially when it comes to video. We kind of peaked about 4 years ago.
Right.
And we're now just kind of trickling in new stuff, in my opinion. Like, the A7S III kind of peaked, and then now everything is just a repackaged A7S III, which is interesting, and it's an amazing camera. But it means now it's pretty much impossible to buy a new bad camera for video, especially from Sony or from, like, Lumix or Canon. So it feels like now going back to the specialist stuff is where you get all of the new hype as well. I mean, Nikon with their ZF and ZFC, and, like, Lumix tried with the S9 and things like that. I think going back to the more specialist stuff is really engaging people again, rather than just trying to go for specs, like top trump spec sort of thing.
Well, it's just not very exciting, is it? Or interesting after a certain point.
Yeah.
You know, it's diminishing returns. It's so clearly diminishing returns at this point that you kind of, you know, like, I look at my, I have an M11, and I read rumors around what an M12 might be, and I'm sort of like, well, what can they do? You know, it's a 60 megapixel full frame sensor as it is. You know, they're not going to change the lens mount at this point. They're not going to, you know, like, what are they going to add?
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it's a manual focus rangefinder, so there's not a heap you can do anyway. Which actually, one of my other lenses is for my Canon rangefinders, which is a 35mm Canon Leica thread mount.
Right, yeah.
That is gorgeous. But I had to buy from someone in France, because I couldn't find it anywhere in the UK, for my Canon 7 and my L3. But I now adapt that to Sony E-mount as well. And I shoot with that just like a rangefinder. It's just all zone focus marks, super nice little lens, very compact. I think that, like, unique way of shooting as well, I feel like in digital, obviously the Ricoh GRs kind of have that with their snap focus and things. They have kind of zone focusing into the display. But having that more zone focusing approach as well, I think everyone you know who's tried it gets hooked. And especially for photography, when it comes to video, having autofocus continuous is so good.
Yes.
But once you get into the zone focusing with hyperfocal, it makes it so much fun for shooting street. I think that's probably the only thing that would lean me towards Leica in the future is just, I want a nice rangefinder zone focus setup.
Yeah. It's a lovely time. Like, I will say that, like, I'm very, very lucky boy. It's a lovely toy to play with. And it's a way of shooting that speaks to me. I'm not sure I could go back to autofocus and fully trust it initially. Like, I'm sure I'd get used to it, but I keep coming back to in my head, like, how does it know what to focus on? Like, I know it's got eye tracking. I know that they can detect different animals. I know all these things. It's just, I kind of now psychologically, my head is like in the 70s almost and just kind of can't quite get on board with the idea of my eye not choosing what I'm focusing on and like not having that direct connection to driving the thing. They're definitely worth trying for sure. Like even like an M9 or an M240, you know, they're kind of affordable in Leica terms. And the glass for me is the star. Like the handling and the experience is one thing, but the lenses are, once you start looking through those lenses, you're like, oh, this is really nice. I can see what all the fuss is about. And I can see, you know, they make so few cameras. I can totally see why they feel they have to charge what they charge. But they seem more in the mix than they were a few years ago. But like you say, the thing for me is, like you say, everyone's making good cameras now. Like they're all, it's very hard to buy a bad camera. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think especially, yeah, when it comes to video, it's really hard. When it comes to photography, it's really hard. But I think it's something as well, everyone who's a beginner will hop between lots and lots of different things, trying to try out what's best and what's going to do the best in this situation, what's going to do the best in this situation. But as you practice and you get better at whichever genre it is that you're shooting, after a while you realize, oh, I can shoot as well with a cheaper, older camera than I can with a brand new camera. So actually it doesn't really come down to the gear that much. But there's always going to be like the bells and whistles of a specific camera that work for how you shoot. But I agree, when you shoot just with a manual focus approach, like I do a lot of that with film photography, once you do that for a period of time without any digital, you do kind of, once you get back to an LCD display with autofocus, it does feel a little bit more like, oh, this is kind of disconnecting me from the shooting experience. But when you're like zone focusing through or manual focusing through an optical viewfinder, I find that the much more engaging way to shoot. Like if I could, I would shoot film all the time, but it's just so crazy expensive for the film and for processing. These days it's like, great, I'm going to shoot like a fifth of the amount of photos that I would usually.
I was going to ask you actually off the back of film and developing costs and stuff like that, what's your preferred film body then? Because obviously on digital we've covered the Sony, which was one of your lenses as well, which is really nice. But what's your preferred film body and lens setup these days?
Typically now it will be one of the Canon rangefinders. So Canon 7, which is probably it's the last model line they made of rangefinders. Sadly, the one that I've got, the frame lines broke. So they can't change anymore. They used to be able to change them between 35, 50 and 85. And it's now kind of stuck halfway between 35 and 50. But luckily, if you're using a 35mm lens on it, it's kind of the whole viewfinder anyway. But it's really nice, like big, bright viewfinder that's really nice to shoot with. But loading the film on that camera is an absolute pain. It's the teeth are like really worn down. So you always take like a minute or two to load. So the L3, which is a much older one from like 1957, I think, that one's in such good nick. And there's no issue with frame lines, really easy to load, which honestly becomes a problem. And yeah, I really like shooting with that. And that's got a nice rangefinder viewfinder used with the 35mm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you give me that and like a few rolls of HP5 on a grey day, I'm happy. You can just take my phone off me, I'll be fine. But other than that, I have my Minolta X700, which is the only one that I have a 28mm lens for. But I've had that camera for like 11 years. So I do love that as well, but purely with the 28mm. The viewfinder is filthy on the inside. It's all scratched up. But it's, to me, I see through all that. I'm like, oh, it is kind of scuffed, but I can see, so it's fine. But yeah, I love shooting dogs with the 28mm on that camera, because one of those you can get, you have to obviously get right down on the ground to look through the viewfinder. But it's really nice. You can get kind of like dogs in the foreground and people in the background. And it's a really nice separation between like the on the ground dog subject and then their owners as like supporting subjects in the background. So that's always like, as soon as I get looking through that viewfinder again, I just find myself crouching down to the floor. I'm like, there's so many fun shots to do like this. So yeah, it's a very unique shooting experience.
Is that where you're using your, no, I guess the L mount. So I wanted to like to segue onto one of your other lens choices. The Canon lens seems like a good one to jump onto maybe next, but that's an L mount. So that's a modern lens.
No. So this is a L39. So it's a Leica 39mm screw mount. So it's the same mount that would work on a lot of the older Leica cameras as well. So to me, it's like my Leica lens. I'm like, if it can go on a Leica body, it's the same.
Yeah.
But that's what I use on the L3 and the 7.
I mean, my favorite lens on my Leica body is the Zeiss. So I'm already a heretic for even considering the Zeiss 35-28. That's the other thing I liked about your lens collection, is that only one of them is quicker than 2.8, right? Like your, you know, F2 is fine. A lot of like dream lens setups, I suppose, or, you know, setups that we convince ourselves are great. Like it has to go down to f1.4, otherwise it's not some sort of aspirational lens. I'm like, no, it's not. 2.8's really good. Like that used to be a fast lens. That's what people forget.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as well, I have one 1.8 lens that I've only had for about a month. And it's fine. It's great. Like, it does the job. But for me, it's like, I don't really go down to 1.8. You know, if I do, it's because it's very dark. Like, that's pretty much it. I'm never really trying to get something super shallow depth of field. I'll do that much more for video, because B-roll always looks nice with shallow depth of field. But when it comes to photography, I'm like f4, 5.6, 8, 11. If it's bright enough, I'll go to f16. Like, I don't mind. If I can shoot and everything's in focus, that's great. I don't have to worry.
Yeah.
It's always a lot more fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think now everything I have, yeah, it's 2.8, I've got 1.2, and then that one 1.8 lens that's autofocus.
Yeah.
And that's it. But I have no intentions of changing. No. Like, it's, for me, if they do the job, that's what matters. Because even if it's a 1.8, I'm going to stop down anyway.
Yeah. No, I think that's the thing. I briefly considered the possibility of like saving up one day and getting like the one of the Sumilux like lenses like that goes down to 1.4, but that would be just to give you the versatility in the bag. But then the problem is, as you say, most of the time you're shooting at 2.8 or above, because maybe you've got a few people and you don't want to get just the eyelashes of one person in focus, and so you kind of need to go higher anyway. Like, that's the thing, is like, it's a lovely idea. But depending on, if especially if you've got to do something for a job, or it's a freelance gig or something like that, you have to actually deliver a usable asset. This isn't navel gazing and, you know, like just for funsies at that point. Like, it's, you're taking, or with dogs, you're taking a picture of something. You can't take multiple pictures and stack focus. Like, you just need to take a picture and go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think as well, it's something that everyone comes to in their own way. Cause like, when you first get a prime lens and you get the Nifty 15, it's 1.8. Mm.
Yeah,
you're addicted to 1.8 and it's amazing. But after a bit, you realize no one's sharp. I think people should start being sharp in my photos. Let's stop down.
Yeah, well, especially if you want to then crop in. Because I really liked your video about being able to, like, removing the stigma around cropping recently. That was a really good one. Where did that, I mean, for people who've not seen it, like, where did the idea for that come from for you? Was it just this realization that you were avoiding it and that you shouldn't be avoiding it, and that it was like a received rule or something?
I think it's something I've been putting all of my photos that I liked of mine on a pedestal if they weren't cropped.
Right.
And I'd be like, oh, I got that perfect in camera. And I'd be like, a little like extra win for me. No one else knows. No one else knows. But to me, I'm like, that's not even, I didn't even correct the level. That's just amazing. And then later I would start to see a good image inside a larger frame. And I'd be like, oh, but if I crop in, it's going to be really low resolution. there's going to be these issues, people are going to notice, I shouldn't do it. Then after a while, I just started cropping in a little bit more and been like, well, this is now a nice frame with that crop.
Yeah.
So even if I'm going to lose a bit of resolution, maybe it's obvious that it's been cropped. Isn't the final image what matters most? It doesn't really matter how you got there, you know? Same like if you're talking about painters, they don't just copy what's in front of them. They interpret, they do things to it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of that thought thread. And that video had been sort of written for like a couple of months. And then I randomly picked it up again one day and I kind of knew how to do it. And I thought, okay, cool, I'm going to make this one. Because it's not the most attractive video. It's not something that people are like, oh, yay, tell me about cropping. But for me, it was like, I need to get this brain dump out onto the internet and then it can exist there. But yeah, it's definitely been a good lesson for me. And I, you know, you can go back through all the different people who have cropped a lot, like celebrated photographers, and you can go and see all these amazing examples of their work that were cropped. And you start to realize, like, why was I being so precious about this? Like, everyone's doing it. And it's part of the reason people will get like a 60 megapixel camera is so that they can crop. Like, why wouldn't you give yourself the option?
Yeah, I was playing with that actually. Hugh Brownstone had him on recently, and he's big on this as he gets older. He's like, I just don't want to carry a bag of glass around with me anymore. And if I can take one lens for the whole day, then that's great. And actually, I tried it here. We've got, I've been playing recently with a mad vintage lens. I don't know if you saw on Instagram, but like it's a 560 and 400 mil R mount lens that I'm adapting to my M. So,
oh, nice.
Have you seen it?
No, I did see it. I didn't realize that's what focal length it was.
Yeah, 560 or 400. It's got two and it looks like a gun. Like, to anyone listening who's not seen it, go back and look at my Instagram. It does look like you're holding a gun, but you've got a camera on the end of it. It's brilliant. It's very, very silly. Although, and it's a trigger to focus. So you squeeze a big trigger. And so actually, in a funny way, it's like it's a very nice, quick way of establishing focus with something that's quite far away. I was using it, my kids were skiing at the weekend and I was watching them and like focusing on them like, you know, half a mile away or whatever it felt like. And it was brilliant for that. But using that, and then the other day the woodpecker was in the garden again and I just had my 35 on and I did exactly that. I set the sensor to 60 again because I normally shoot at 36 because I'm a tourist and I don't need to worry about like 60 megapixel raw files, like who's got time for that. And I set it to 60 and I cropped in, and for on a phone screen you get away with murder. This is the thing that we don't realize, is that there's no point having all that latitude if you never use it. And so actually it was just nice to kind of treat myself to a silly little picture of a woodpecker, set it to black and white. Actually it was quite nice. He's in the middle, sharp enough. There's enough of him.
I just want to quickly ask. So your kids were skiing you're in Scotland, right?
Yes.
Whereabouts are you in Scotland that they can go skiing?
Up near Cairngorm.
Interesting.
Yeah, so up on the mountain there. So we had a dump of snow about 2 weeks ago. Then we had a 30 degree temperature shift over one night from like minus 10 to like, you know, almost 20. And so it all melted. It all went almost immediately. But they have a bit on the mountain that they call the patch. And that stays, it's a combination of, it's in a little valley and it's cold and so the snow stays. And they have a thing called a snow machine, which basically, it's probably the worst thing in the world, but it can turn water into snow. And if you need it to, it can produce like 4 tons of snow in an hour.
And it replaces where it's all melted and stuff.
Exactly. It basically sprinkles out a bit of snow onto the mountainside and then people pack it down. Seems to work. And they can go and snow. They can go and ski on the patch. But now, as I talk to you today, it's 0 degrees again, and they're expecting that like it's blue skies, but like there might be snow again later this week. So yeah, they can go up and ski on the patch, and I go and take up my silly gun camera and take some pictures of them there. I'm practicing fast moving subjects with it. Basically, I want to take it to the MotoGP because the images it makes are so vintage and odd looking, and the coatings are kind of going on it a little bit. So there's like a purple cast over one part of the lens on the 400. The 560 seems better. I think it's been used less. I think it's a bit sharper. It's got a bigger disc in the middle that is in focus and sharp, because it is a 30 some year old lens, 35 years old. But yeah, it's absurd. And carrying that thing around weighs a ton. as well, obviously. And although it was cheap, necessitated a VisiFlex to go with it as well, so I could actually focus the thing, because it's not rangefinder coupled, so rather than using the back of a screen. So yeah, it's definitely the least sensible way to achieve what I'm achieving, but that's kind of partly why I love it, is that, look, I can do this with an M.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's also, it's one of those really unique shooting experiences, like without having to change cameras completely and like go, you know, go to medium format or something like that. You're just going like, I just want to throw a silly lens on the front and have fun with it. I also now kind of want to have a go with that method of focusing. That sounds really interesting. I've never heard of a lens focusing like that. So that sounds cool.
It's really, really bizarre. And it is just you pull a trigger and it just like extends and contracts. Which it basically makes your camera look like a telescope. It's like attaching your camera to a telescope almost, except this telescope has like a gun grip on the bottom. The one thing that it does have, the original camera, when it mounted with an R, because the R was a film camera, there's a DIN port on the side and then a cable that you could put into the auto winder add-on for the R. So in the original promotional material for the camera, for the lens, they've got the R on the back. He's got a stock attached so it can go into his shoulder to reduce shake. So all of this works in the way that you hold it like with both hands. And there was a button on the front, which I think was the original shutter release if you were using the cable into the base of the camera. And so you could pull this whole thing like shooting a shotgun. You could pull it into your shoulder to reduce shake. Was the idea. And so this whole, the whole mechanism, the pulling the trigger for focus, everything. You can also lock focus. There's a twist on the top to lock focus in place. So if you're taking a photo of this thing, a thing that's always in the same place, kind of, you can just lock focus and then fire off. It's an absurd invention. Like it's one of those evolutionary cul-de-sacs that exist when like you've got a very specific problem to solve. But in the fullness of time, what you realize is this was only going to be a problem for 5 minutes. Because eventually digital was going to come along. You weren't going to have to worry about winding film. You weren't going to have to worry about shake in the same way. Maybe you've got IBIS. Like, you know, anyone who shoots with a modern Nikon, Canon or Sony system will find the lengths I'm going to be absurd, and will point out to me that for the money I've invested in this, I'd be halfway to an older, say, A7 body, but with IBIS. And everything, and probably a decent lens. I could get a long lens, and then you could do, you know. But would it be as much fun, George?
That's exactly. I now am thinking just like how much R&D went into that system to create essentially a camera bazooka. And I now quite want to play with one. I see a lot of R bodies around, but I never really see lenses for them. But I feel like that's a rabbit hole I could easily fall into one day.
Yeah.
After my year of one camera, that might go on my list.
This is the problem, isn't it? You're going to fall off the wagon so hard. December 31, 2025.
Look, man, 2026 is our year, man. Let's go. Like, I can feel it. I can feel it. Well, I think by that time, I may be, it's going to be kind of, part of the reason I wanted to do it for this year is I'm in Manchester for the next few months until like our lease is up. And then after that, we might be kind of on the road for a bit, for like the second half of 2025, which would be really fun. And then at the end of that, most likely like January 26, we'll be settling in London and moving down south. So by that point, the camera chains will be off.
Yeah.
And I'll be in street photography paradise.
Yes.
And yeah, so I'm kind of been like, okay, cool. Let's just not focus on cameras. Let's travel about, have some fun. Don't worry about that. Then when I get to London, it'll be like, okay, we've got a problem. MPB is going to be completely out of stock and everything.
Yeah, London but, Camera Exchange, all these places. Yeah, you can hit them all up. No, it's very dangerous being down there. So you mentioned it's like the home of street. You're really excited by the sounds of it to get out on the streets in London.
Every single time I go down and shoot, I have a great day. It's just so good. I mean, you forget, I mean, just in terms of people who live there and then tourism and stuff like that. A lot of people I know who live there do not like going to central London, which I understand. They want to stay in the area they live in and have a nice, relaxed time relative to the rest of London. But for me, I'm like, well, let's go to central because it's where everyone is at and there's loads of stuff happening. The light is often incredible, beautiful architecture in different parts. I think in the UK, you know, we have some really beautiful cities, but Manchester, sadly, I wouldn't say is one of them. It's got some nice bits, but a lot of it is quite hard to work with when you're shooting street. It's a lot of kind of grey and like red brick and stuff like that. But then in London, I find it just gorgeous, like across most of it. Same thing whenever I go to Italy, if I can go into Venice or something for a day. Epic. Always so good, especially when the sun's coming down in Venice. It's like, oh my God, just leave me on the front, running up and down my camera, and I'll have a great time.
I do love that about having a camera. You've always got something to do, and there's always something to look at and always something to see. Like you were talking about mini assignments on a recent video, which I really love that idea as well, like setting yourself little challenges, but not just take this many photos or like a smaller memory card or stuff, but like, you know, can you shoot numbers? Can you shoot patterns? Can you see a color and stuff like that? I really like that idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like to gamify things, like with everything. And for street photography, I think if you are kind of maybe a bit low energy one day, or you're kind of like, you're too busy thinking about something else in the back of your mind, it can be nice just to go, okay, I'm just going to focus on, yeah, sets of three people or block colors or different textures or patterns, if people are wearing like matching patterns. And once you start to think about it, things start to happen and you start to notice things. And I think even if you're not doing that some days, like the observational awareness that you get from doing that practice, I think helps me a lot when I'm shooting in new places. And yeah, I've been doing it now for quite a while, but only recently really trying to explain it. But I'll go out a lot of the time, and if I get kind of one theme in a shot and I like it, I'll challenge myself to shoot three or five more of a shot like that. And be like, can I repeat something similar? Can I do that better? Is there another way that this could be done that might be more interesting? And I find it a very good way just to improve your awareness. Because when it comes to street photography, the technical requirements are quite low. Like we've talked about, you can use a manual focus camera, be pretty chill. There's not a lot of like scrutiny of like, oh, pixel peeping on sharpness and things like that. So a lot of it comes down to, are you spotting something interesting? And are you able to observe and like shoot something interesting regardless of where you are? So I find those kind of mini assignments to be really valuable. I kind of wish I'd gotten into doing them earlier, because for ages I'd just go out and shoot whatever, but then you'd come back with a few hundred images, delete like most of them, and have five random shots and be like, okay, I guess these are photos, but there's not really much about them. So it's nice to try and work on collections at the same time.
I think once you kind of establish the things that you do like to photograph, then you can be getting your reps in, because then you know what you're building towards something. It doesn't have to be a body of work. Like, I think that's the other mistake a lot of, you know, I'm unburdened by it being my job, right? I never have freelance gigs to worry about. I don't have to do this for a living. I am at play all of the time. But even then, like you say, that feeling of coming home with a full memory card but no idea why can be really demoralizing and can put you off a hobby if you're kind of new to it or if you're coming to this thing. So finding the people whose work you admire, that's why I like that you have the kind of consistent themes around like dogs, for example, of like a thing that you return to, because there's actually, that sounds really simple, right? It's like people who take photos of birds. When I was taking photos of birds recently in the garden, suddenly, and animals, and suddenly I was like, oh, this, yeah, I can see Dan Milner, who was previously on the show, really big into shooting birds, and I was sending him some of my pictures. He was like, this is how it starts, man. This is going to be you now. And now I go places and I'm looking up and I'm looking for birds. And it's like, what have I become?
That's fair, yeah. At the moment, I am very much looking down. So I wonder if at some point my eye level is just going to slowly go up into the trees, which I mean, I wouldn't mind, but lenses will get heavier at the same time. I'll have to start shooting on the telephotos.
Yeah, one day I think you just notice something and it speaks to you. And then, you know, like my mate Danny, he takes loads of pictures of coffee and things like that. Like it's a thing. And I can always tell a Danny photo. And it's like, yeah, it's documentary. But after you spend enough time around someone and around their work, it's like the way they photograph it is different. You can tell a lot about where they are in the world, how they feel about the world, and just from the way that they've arranged things, you know, just from the way it looks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's something, I mean, for me with photographing dogs, like I used to at one point just be like, am I just kind of doing some of those kind of dull dog pics? Like you can't take photos of people, so you're taking photos of dogs. But me, it became much more like, I feel like I have a special affinity with dogs, and I really like to see kind of from their eye level. I always shoot from like their eye level, and I always try and get more of the scene in at the same time. I never try and have it just the dog with background blur. I always try to get the people around where we are, because I sometimes think like, people are funny, dogs are funny, people with dogs are funny. Like, it's kind of, there is always something going on there. Like, you can sort of tell what they do and like where they're from, like where we are. And yeah, I've got a very long, a very big folder of dog photos, some with their owners, some without their owners, that someday I'll do something with, but I'm in no rush. I know at some point I'll be like, cool, I've got like a few hundred images that I really like. Let's start to go through and sequence them and see what happens.
Well, I want to get onto your last lens, but on the subject of low down photos, do you know a photographer called Kev Meredith? Lomo Kev is what he used to be.
Rings a bell,
So he
yes.
lives, I think he's still in Brighton, and he used to exclusively shoot with the Lomo LCA film camera. That's why he was known as Lomo Kev. Back in that, so I'm going to age myself if my hair and the sound of my voice doesn't do that already. But he used to shoot early days in Flickr. He was a big Flickr person. And I worked at Moodprint at the time, and Flickr were a partner, and so like Heather Champ and people like that, and big Flickr people back in, like, if you were on the internet in like 2004 taking pictures, these are names that you will remember. But Kev had a book, which I think you can probably still find used somewhere. I have a copy of it behind me somewhere. But yeah, his stuff was really good. He used to put his camera like on the ground even, and fire the shutter from ground level, and it was always a really interesting perspective because it was so low down, loads of like really brightly colored, a bit Martin Parr inflected actually, in the like the super saturated colors that you get from that lens on that camera, the plastic fantastic with the film stuff. So yeah, really really cool. Look him up. He's quite fun because I feel like
Yeah,
he's
I
got some
definitely
dogs.
will.
He also does a lot of, or has done a lot of, photography of people swimming, like open water swimming at Brighton, near the pier. And people who go and swim there, he did a lot of stuff with that. Like, he used to wade out and take his camera with him, and you'd get like these swimmers going out into the water. It was amazing.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out.
Yeah, Kev's good. Lomo Kev. That's a part of my brain I haven't accessed for a long time. But I'm conscious you've been very generous with your time, so I will bring things to a close soon. But tell me about the Tamron, because I don't know anything about zoom lenses. Like, my 560mm prime is where my head goes, or a 135 or something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, zoom lenses for me are like not really that exciting. I'm often shooting with primes, but when it comes to video, a zoom is kind of invaluable. And this particular one is an ultra wide zoom, but it's 17 to 28 on full frame. And then this is the only lens, this and it's the 28 to 75 Tamron. I have both, but these are the only two lenses that I've kept for the last like 5 years because they just go between all the different Sony bodies. And as long as I'm with Sony, I'm going to have these lenses. But this 17 to 28 is literally my do it everything filming lens. So it probably gets the most mileage out of everything. But sometimes I think like I don't give it enough credit. I'm always talking about other more like quirky, exciting lenses, but this one is just like, oh, chef's kiss. Like it doesn't extend when you zoom. So a lot of the time I've shot at like tech events and things like that, and I'll have my camera on a gimbal. And I can zoom on the lens without adjusting the gimbal balance. And then on Sony cameras, you can then crop in to APS-C and then crop in again with clear image zoom. So it becomes like an ultra wide lens that goes up to like a 64mm equivalent on a gimbal or whatever else you're doing. So it's very much like my Swiss Army knife of a lens. And yeah, for most things, if I'm taking my camera with me, I'm going to do some video, I just bring that lens and an ND filter. And that's it. And I know I'm pretty much going to be covered. I don't really shoot above like 50 mil anyway. So with the crops and stuff, it can get me there. I do use it for photography occasionally, but it does make the camera a lot bigger. That's probably the only trade-off. But for the most part, for video, it's like a one and done setup, which I love.
And is it okay enough that you can hold it out in front of you as well to do a bit of vloggy style stuff?
If you wanted to, yeah, I mean 17 mil on a full frame, you don't even have to hold it out that far, and
Right.
you've got a lot of room.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty good for that sort of thing. But yeah, these days, I mean, to be honest, the vlogging thing is not really a proper camera, but the DJI Pocket 3, there's a
Yes.
reason there's a reason everyone has it. I thought, I'm going to get it. I'm going to hate it. I'll send it back.
Yeah.
I'm in. I've drank the Kool-Aid. I'm like, this thing is absolutely amazing. Yeah. Got a mist filter for it. Ooh, it's good. It's just a unique, it's one of those little like utilitarian creative tools.
Yes.
It's not really, you can't do a lot with it, but the stuff that it can do, it does the best.
Yeah.
So when it comes to vlogging now, I don't even think about taking a mirrorless camera. I just go, oh, well, I'll take the Pocket 3.
Yeah.
And whatever I'm going to take photos with. And I'm done.
It's a very specific weapon. I remember when the first one came out, I was saving up for a Leica Q at the time, before I had an M, before like I was looking at the RX. And I remember, this, I'm such an idiot, I made a presentation for my wife to explain why I was not saving up for the Q anymore and I was just going to buy the Osmo Pocket. And the rationale was that I had an A7 at the time. And I was gonna potentially stop using a 24 megapixel full frame camera to then sell it and then spend more to get a fixed lens 24 megapixel full frame camera that would not enable me to do anything any more than I could do today. Whereas the Pocket was like all this stuff that I couldn't do at the time. I didn't have a good slow-mo setup. I couldn't shoot 4K video on anything, you know. So, and it was an incredible camera. I loved it. And in the end, I sold it because I wasn't using it anymore because I'm not really a video person and I didn't really have a project in mind for it. But I feel like they discovered something with that camera. They made something really, really good. It's here to stay.
Yeah. So weirdly enough, DJI, obviously with the drones, I've owned two of their drones and I've sold both their drones because drones are a lot like GoPros. Like you buy one thinking, I do so much action. Look at all the action I'm going to film. And suddenly you realize, I'm actually not that action-packed of a person. So then you sell the GoPro.
Yeah.
Same thing with the drone. You're like, how often am I really filming these epic, you know, vistas?
Yeah.
Like, not so much in the city. But the Pocket 3, I fully attributed to that. I was like, I need to buy it. I need to know. And I can send it back, whatever. But then after a while, I like it. My girlfriend likes to use it for making videos as well. And we're both just like, oh no, this thing's staying. And actually, to be fair, if they get a Pocket 4... I'll probably keep the 3 and get the 4. I don't know. I'm in. Same thing with the DJI Action 4. I think that's the first action camera I've actually got proper use out of because they've made it so it connects with their microphones. They're really creating a very unique creative tool for like online creators. Like it's getting to the point where, you know, I use Sony for the more pro stuff and the more, you know, using interchangeable lenses. But when it comes to just documenting, DJI are really getting a lot of things right. So I'm excited to see what happens and if we ever get like an interchangeable lens camera from them as well, I would be really excited for.
I think they're an interesting company because they stay mostly in their lane, but they do step outside of it sometimes in ways where you think, well, how's that going to work? And then actually, like the microphones were that for me when they first did the microphones. Well,
yeah. I think when it comes to the microphones, they made the Rode Wireless Pros potentially better. It's sort of up to the debate which one you prefer. When it comes to action cameras, they've beat GoPro. Like GoPro haven't made a good action camera to be able to compete with them.
Yeah.
So I do sort of think this is one of the more exciting camera companies. I'm just going to preview this. I do actually have a video essay about DJI that I am slowly in the work of, but I want to speak to some people at DJI before I make it.
Yeah.
I want to find out some more stuff. But I do think they're probably the most exciting brand at the moment. So I'd really like to see if they made like an L mount because they are they're part of the L mount alliance.
I didn't know their
Ronin 4D, I think.
Right.
That might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure they are. So if they did like a compact full frame L mount, we're cooking.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Oh, well, watch the space. Maybe they'll do that for 26 just in time for you to be able to actually. Like guilt-free.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I, honestly, though, if that happened halfway through this year, this whole thing falls apart.
We can come back and change it.
If I only have one for a few days, maybe it's okay. Maybe I can cheat.
Yeah. If it's a loaner, that probably doesn't count. There we go.
So if they lend it to you, you use it for a while. I'll have to make friends with DJI first, but that is totally on the cards.
Yes. Oh, amazing. Well, thank you so much for being on the show as well and agreeing over social media to take part in an episode of Prime Lenses. It was great. I love it when people go, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, of course. It was a lot of fun. It's great chatting to you.
For people listening who maybe don't know, because I get people listening in the States and Australia and places like that as well, where can they find you on the internet?
If you search George Holden on YouTube, and I think mostly on Google, you should be able to find my YouTube and my Instagram and website where I have my blog. My Instagram is at George Holden Media, just because someone else stole George Holden. So apart from that, I'm George Holden everywhere.
I sympathise, but from the other way. There was another Ian Farrell in Glasgow, and I used to always beat him to stuff, and he was very annoyed. And then he beat me to some social network at one point and messaged me and was like, I've beaten you to this one, and I can't remember the name of it, which tells you how successful that social network was. But yeah, it can be a pain when there's someone else in your lane.
Yeah, well, I tried to reach out to my Instagram doppelganger, and I tried to be like, oh, can I please, you know, you're not using this account. And literally they set it up, maybe posted once, and then abandoned it like over 10 years ago. So I'm just sort of like, please, please let me have it. But oh well, we're sticking with George Holden Media for now.
It's good. It's good. You're a brand.
Yeah. It's a brand.
You're a brand. Cool. Well, have a lovely rest of day, mate. I really enjoyed this. Thanks for chatting.
Well, yeah. No, of course. Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing it when it comes out as well.
It'll be in your ears in no time, a couple of weeks.
Cool. Lovely. Well, thanks very much.
All right, man. Take care. See you soon.
All right. Take care. See ya.
Thanks, George. I really enjoyed that conversation. I hope you did as well. If the listening public enjoy the episode, don't forget you can like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. So that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube Music, all the musics. Give us a review there. That'll help other people find the show. You can also subscribe to the midweek newsletter that goes out on a Wednesday, and that's on ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there is a link to it in the show notes. And you can support us on Patreon as well, which helps to pay for the bills, keep us in tea and biscuits. There you go. Do you know, listening back to that as I was editing it, maybe I need a DJI Osmo Pocket again. You'll have to tune in again to find out whether I cave. I probably won't cave. Oh, maybe. The Insta360 is very good as well. You know, that little one that's like a pill. Casey Neistat put that in a mug of coffee once and drank it. I mean, not all the way down. Do you know what? I'm getting distracted. This is wasting both of our time. You have an amazing week. We'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for your ears. See ya.